program is going to be called Whatever Became of AB's Irish Rose, although I don't think we'll be limited to the one program because my two guests today have worked on many, many programs. I have a credit sheet in front of me from the lady whose name is Betty Winkler, who was, of course, the Irish Rose. Are you Irish, by the way?
No, I'm not.
Is that your real name, Betty Winkler?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
And a member of my stock company, this is Carl Eastman.
Oh, yeah, this makes it twice now.
Yeah, you're the
both very happily.
Who's been on twice.
Oh, really?
John Gibson's the only one who was on before, and I told him the same day that you were going to be back, so.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it last time.
Good. We didn't say what part you played. Maybe you better tell them, because I...
As I recall, I was AB's friend, or one of his friends, David Lerner, I think.
David Lerner.
The character was.
I must say how I found both of you, although I knew where you were, but I mean why I associated with you with this program, because there's a book called Radio's Golden Age, and it's published now, and it's by Frank Buxton and Bill Owen. Let's see, the publisher is the Easton Valley Press. And I know you can buy it all over New York. I don't know about California, but I think if you wrote to the Easton Valley Press or to Brentano's or Doubleday's here, you could get it. It's, I think, a very interesting book. It gives the complete cast of many of the, all of the old radio programs. So anyway, so much for a plug for a very good book.
Will at least be bought, I'm sure, by the about 25,000 indigent radio actors.
Uh-huh.
Everybody who's been on
I'm going program, right out and buy it right after the show.
It's amazingly accurate, really, considering how far they had to go back and how few records there were. I talked with both of them about, you know, the few records and programs that are kept of these old programs. They're just non-existent.
I know. There are some recordings around, I think, but I don't
very
know who has them.
Even some dreadful tapes. A friend of mine sent me a tape of about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it was a rather horrifying experience to hear me on a program called Bobby Benson.
Oh, yeah, and the Barbie...
And the Barbie Ranch, and there was a character called Wendy Wales, who was played by a fellow who's done reasonably well since, by the name of... I'm fine. He was on the Griffin show. He played the frightened deputy sheriff. What's his name? He's very a strong gust of wind would blow him over. Now he's been on this TV thing for about 4 years.
The more you talk about him, the more confused.
Yes. The less I recognize
him. Oh, this is ridiculous. No, really, because I knew him so it'll come to me probably when we're talking about AB.
Well, our engineer knows, but I can't seem to read his lips through the glass. Who is it? I can't hear. We'll learn after the podcast.
I'll tell you. It'll come to me. It's ridiculous, but he... His voice, of course, hasn't changed, and he played a beautiful character called Windy Wales, an imaginary hero who was very heroic, of course, in his own eyes. But now that the engineer is putting up his name.
Yeah, but
I can't see it from here. It was a nice try, though, and I'm sorry I started the whole thing. Please forgive me.
How long since you've two seen each other?
Oh, it must be 15 or 16 years.
I would think so, Betty.
Mm-hmm. And Carl and I used to work together very often, so I'm truly delighted to see him.
Well, it's a joy to see you.
I think that's the thing I miss more than anything else about radio, the fact that we did get accustomed to seeing certain people and working with certain people, and it was more like a stock company, so that you formed rather friendly relationships. You know, and I didn't think that's quite so true with television.
Well, I think
it?
It's almost impossible because radio is kind of a small town.
Yeah.
Where most
of
us met either at the drugstore on NBC or at Colby's over at CBS.
Yeah, and there's not that much visiting on the set either of a television program.
No.
At least not of the soaps that I've been on visiting, you know, friends that, as opposed to radio studios, where they really seem to have had a very good time.
Yes, it was wonderful. And I think it served a very good purpose. I mean, those were the days of more of the primary relationships where people got to know each other fairly well. Now it all seems so big that you have actors running in to do a show and running out and never seeing that particular group of people again. Is that true, Carl? Or is
I would think so. Well, of course, TV takes so much concentration of necessity.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And in radio, particularly in the daytime strip shows, we used to rehearse about an hour and spend most of the hour sitting around a table yakking.
Yeah.
And maybe do two run-throughs and go on the air. I think that was about
I don't know any jokes anymore. I used to hear all the new jokes, you know, sitting around before rehearsal.
There certainly were quite a few of them. And then we met so frequently in between while you were waiting to go from show to show. And on TV, it's entirely different. You go in and work all day or for several days, depending on whether it's a daytime show or a more important one.
Uh-huh.
There was a tremendous and beloved informality about radio that we all enjoyed.
Wonderful.
How long was the ABC Irish shows on the air? Does anyone know?
I think about 2 or 3 years.
I think so.
Yeah, it was on a long time.
I was saying before you got here, I think it's so lovely. You remember Anna Appel?
Oh, very well.
Who, if you remember, hadn't had any stage experience. I mean, she and Menasha Skolnick, who was so marvelous on the show, came up from
Excuse
the...
Excuse me, but you mean she had no radio experience?
Oh, did
yes,
I take the
other? She was in the
She was strictly from the theater, and she would plant herself firmly in front of the microphone, if you remember, and nobody could get anywhere near her.
No one could get near the microphone. Yes, I do remember.
And who was
that?
It was either Betty Gard or Adelaide Klein who would put her arm around her shoulder and just gently shove her right out of the way when she had to have a speech.
Did you have a studio audience?
Oh, yeah. We were in 8H, which was the
best. So you had to be kind of careful. I mean, you couldn't really just give her a push.
No, you had to be ostensibly polite, at least.
Stott Cotworth told me a wonderful story about radio after we finished recording, which is when you hear the best stories, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
People think of them on the way down the stairs.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you know, we had a studio audience for Casey Crime Photographer. And he said, John Gibson, who was with him, he said, do you remember the kid in the audience right in the middle of one of the most dramatic scenes? He said, yes, immediately remembered. A kid had a portable radio, and all at once they started picking up in the control booth NBC. But this show was supposed to be on CBS. And everyone started looking. They couldn't imagine where the sound was coming from, and he was playing a portable radio. Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons.
Oh,
whatever
competition.
Went coast to coast.
Incidentally, apropos of nothing, I just remembered the gentleman's name, which is Don Knotts, who is reasonably well.
Oh, Don Knotts, of course.
Yeah. And your engineer is very glad I finally made it.
We had a very funny thing with AB's Irish Rose one night. Ann Nichols, who wrote it, was quite an imposing person. Remember her, Carl?
I certainly do.
And one night, Menasha invited us all to the Yiddish Theater down on 2nd Avenue. And Anne wore an enormous sable coat, which I think she had brought from Russia 20 years before, you know. And we were sitting, waiting for the play to start, and some girl came in and sat in front of Anne, who had on an enormous picture hat. And, of course, Anne couldn't see. So she leaned forward, and she said, would you mind removing your hat? And the girl just looked at her and didn't touch the hat. And again, Anne, who was very Irish and had a lot of spirit, said, I said, would you mind removing your hat? And he says, all right, all right, and still didn't touch it. And at that point, Anne just pushed the hat over on her face. And it was just the girl started to scream, and by then the show had started, and we were all so embarrassed. And at the first intermission, Menasha came out and announced that the famous Ann Nichols and the cast of AB's Irish Rose was in the audience. And would Miss Nichols get up and take a bow? So when Ann got out, the girl next to the girl with the hat said, there, you see who you insulted? I hope you're satisfied.
Oh, that's lovely.
Isn't that lovely?
Did she ever have another hit, Ann Nichols?
Not really.
No, she wrote two or three other singularly unsuccessful plays.
She wouldn't have needed one financially.
No,
And also, she had great pride. You know, when she wasn't successful or when the show wasn't being done, she just didn't want anyone to know where she is. She would retire, just retire from the public scene. So that between the time it was a hit on the stage and when she did it on radio, no one had heard of Ann Nichols for years and years.
No, I don't think she ever appeared anywhere.
No.
She's only been dead a couple of years, hasn't she?
Yes, yeah. And I'm so sorry I didn't get to see her before
remember?
She died.
She was a tremendously imposing, very strong-willed lady, as I recall, and I'm sure you do.
Yeah, very amusing.
I think it's very curious about that show. By show, I mean the stage show, because it got bad notices. Nearly completely.
Terrible.
Yeah, it and Tobacco Road, I think, are about the worst notices, and were about as successful as any two plays on Broadway.
Yeah.
I don't know what Tobacco Road's record was, but
it ran almost 8 years.
Really? Well, do you know how long AB's Irish Rose ran?
I would guess 12, but I'm not sure.
2,327 performances. I looked it up.
Wow.
Isn't that astounding?
That's some kind of a record.
I think it is still.
And another thing I think should be borne in mind when you hear a figure like this. In those days, you only had to run a show for like 6 weeks, and it was a hit.
Yeah, they
show didn't have to run that long.
$20,000 back.
Yeah.
Particularly one without music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the average budget
was good show in those days.
Yeah, I would think the average one-set show came in for about 20 grand, wouldn't you think so?
I wouldn't know. I'm not.
No. Well, at the
that's
most,
your department, Carl.
Well, never having produced a Broadway play, I can only speak from hearsay, but I'm quite sure that was about the average cost of bringing a production into New York.
One of the first guests I had on this program, and the only one, I'm sorry to say, who's passed away since, was Nancy Carroll, who did, I guess, the original in the silent movies. I don't know if she... She was on the stage with it, but I don't know if she was the original.
I don't think so.
Irish Rose.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her the night before she died. She was playing in my son-in-law's theater up at the Tappan Zee Playhouse.
Yeah, she told me she was going to do it. Never too late, right.
And it's rather...
Did she die so suddenly, Carl?
Very.
The character herself, if you remember the play, had run up and down the stairs all the time, and she hadn't told anybody she had heart trouble. And... I don't know what happened, but she got later and later, and they tried calling her without success, and finally got a policeman to meet the superintendent and break down her door, and she had just quietly and suddenly died all alone. I think I saw her just the night before it happened.
She was full of energy.
Oh, she was the most delicious woman. She had marvelous stories to tell about her very Irish mother. Did she tell any when she was
there? No.
Oh, this woman must have been absolutely incredible, and she was just delicious. She really was.
Now, she told me that Adolf Zucker, she was brought into his office when she was signed with Paramount about 1927, and he looked at her and he said, "Well, whoever signed you made a great mistake because we couldn't put Pola Negri over because her face was too round and yours is even rounder." I don't know what angle we're going to shoot you from, but don't think your options are going to be picked up. You're a big mistake. She says, I made up my mind that morning I was going to be a star just despite him. She had that kind of drive, really.
Yeah.
And she certainly was, to a great degree. She
was one of the first talkie stars. Mm-hmm. The silent star would tell me that. The first to emerge as a star in the new medium.
Mm-hmm. But I wish there had been tape recorders then. This was 20 years ago, at least, that she used to tell me these marvelous Irish stories which she'd gotten from her mother.
She was married, and I can't think of the man's name, the fellow who did all the caricatures in Sardis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fine. This is my day for remembering nothing. And I know who you mean, of course.
Oh, wait, I'm wrong about that. It's her son-in-law. Her daughter is an agent. I can't think of her name. And it's her son-in-law who does the caricatures. And she was married to, was it the man who wrote Tobacco Road? I think it was Tobacco Road. It was one of the hit plays like that.
I think so.
She was never in the radio show at all, was she? No, I don't remember.
No, she didn't do the radio show. Bud Collier.
To me, it's always lovely because Bud Collier was a...
And Menashe Skolnick, whom I adored. I really found him the most enchanting person.
He is the sweetest man.
He's so sweet, and I remember his spending hours telling me that the way to cure a sore back was to put a piece of flannel on it, and it had to be red. Only red.
That was the most therapeutic
time. We were standing outside of CBS, and I stood listening to this, and, I agreed. What could I do? had to use red flannel if you had a sore back and just place it there.
Oh,
and
that's
that would
marvelous.
Help. Yeah.
Someone else who played Rosemary was Mercedes McCambridge. Did we say that?
No, she never played Rosemary. Oh, you mean
she
Rosemary Navy's Irish
yeah.
Rose.
Yes.
Did she?
After
did
you left.
Did she? Yeah. Oh, that's right.
I had the
right.
pleasure of directing right. Mercy in the first television show she ever did.
She was a very popular radio actress,
oh,
wasn't she?
Oh, extraordinarily.
Well,
so,
she was in Chicago
so.
First. I started working with her when
that's
she was
right.
just out of college.
Yes, yeah, she went to uh-huh. Cardinal Mundelein College
yes.
in Chicago.
Yeah.
But the first time I saw her, maybe it was her first film, was All the King's Men.
Yes.
And she opened her mouth, and I thought, oh, well, that's Mercedes McCambridge.
Uh-huh.
I've been listening
that
to her
was
for
her
years.
First film.
You yeah. know, she's a very old friend of mine. You will love this, Betty. She called me a couple of months ago, and she said, I would really like to be, I hear about all this money that Mandel Kramer and Mason Adams are making doing commercials. She said, couldn't I be a kind of a female Mandy Kramer? I know, with that incredible voice.
Yeah.
There might be something she could do doing commercials, but there would have to be a little offbeat, I think.
I see you were on Inner Sanctum, too,
oh,
Miss
yes.
Winkler.
Yes.
Do you know where Raymond is?
No, I don't.
I'll
I don't
tell you,
know what
I got a lot of
Ray
inquiries
Johnson,
about him.
I'd like to know.
Fine. Gee, fine actor.
Yes, oh, wonderful
so
actor. And
so
was
his wife, Betty
he
Kane.
He was from Chicago also. You see, I knew many of these people from Chicago where I started.
Well, he's living now in Vermont in a very small town. He's with his wife. He's completely retired. His health has been failing for a number of years.
I
and they
know.
Moved there about 2 years
he's
ago.
He's been in a wheelchair for about 8 or 10 years. And I know. Oh, yeah.
But what is he doing? Do you know? Or
nothing
he
at
just
all.
Retired?
He wrote me a very nice letter. This was about a year and a half ago. And he said he had no intention of coming to New York. His health just wouldn't permit it.
Mm-hmm.
But to please... To
he has some kind of progressive off. Bone disease, I think. That,
yeah.
Necessitating
something. I don't know what it is. It's very
remember,
serious.
He used to limp first, mm-hmm. and then he started using a cane,
yes.
and finally it was reduced
oh,
to his coming into the studio on a wheelchair. But mm-hmm. he was so good, and everybody loved him so, that they would call him anyway.
He was your host.
He
yes.
was my
yeah.
host, yes.
You did that show an awful
uh-huh.
lot,
uh-huh.
as I recall.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, when I first started in Chicago, there were about 24 people who did all the shows on the air. We were NBC staff, you see. So we used to work from 9 in the morning to midnight, and we did Lights Out there and all of these shows. But New York was always very different, because there you worked by the show. You
was
know,
Lights Out from Chicago?
Oh, yes. Arch Obler wrote that. I did the first Lights Out show.
And before him, Willis Cooper wrote it.
Willis Cooper wrote it. That's
yes, he
right.
did.
Was that before or before, you're
that's right.
That's right,
and he
I'm
also
sorry.
Did Tales of the Foreign
that's
Legion.
That's right.
And Arch always took all the credit for Lights Out,
no,
but
that's
Bill Cooper
right.
started it,
yes.
actually.
Yes.
There was
Bill?
A fantastic writer.
He was a
marvelous
guy. Writer and a marvelous man.
He, too, was no longer with us. He did a lovely series in New York that Ernest Chappell narrated and used to play the leads on every week
uh-huh.
called... Oh, as I told you before, this is my paper.
You hadn't better
nothing.
Try to think of anything today.
The show just comes to mind now. I must look it up in radio's golden age, because it just now dawned on me. It was called Manhattan at Midnight. Do you all remember that?
I don't
not
know
only
that.
Do I remember it, I have a beautiful story to tell you about it.
Oh, do? I'm going to look it up now while you tell the story.
I was up in Canada with a friend of mine whose family had a place up there for the summer. And he and I just went up alone for about 4 or 5 days. And the only way to reach me was to send a telegram or phone the grocery store in a little town called Westport, Ontario, which is about 12 miles away. And Hank Borum was the director and producer of Manhattan at Midnight. Now, Hank is now with Texas program director. You remember him, don't you, Betty?
Mm-mm.
Anyway, this was shortly after the war had started. We weren't in it yet. I think it was 1940. And I had a call to do Manhattan at Midnight. So my wife sent a telegram up to the store which said Manhattan at Midnight, Wednesday, June 27th. And we drove down on Tuesday, and I got stopped by the immigration authorities. and by several other people because of the strange telegram they thought apparently I was on my way back to sabotage New York. And I had an awful time convincing them that I was just a radio actor and this is the name of a radio program on which I was
talking.
Manhattan at midnight,
isn't
that beautiful?
That
yeah.
I was associate producer, this was about 10 years ago, on an NBC series that never went on the air, but we taped a lot of programs, and one was on New York cop, very famous New York cop named Barney Ruditsky.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, he inspired, I guess, and wrote The Lawless Years, that television series. He's dead now. Well, I rented a 1925 Pierce Arrow it was a gangster car. Ruditsky went with me. He said, this is the kind they used to drive. So we rented one. This was on the coast. We took it down to Pacific Ocean Park along the boardwalk there. And I went out one night, and I thought, well, I'll take the car. I have it anyway in my garage. I'll just drive. It'll be fun. I'm going to a party, and I was picking people up. And we came out of a club where we were in Venice, California, and we walked through the parking lot, and I put my hand on the door and went to get the keys, and someone grabbed me and said, put your hands up. They had guns all over us. There were four policemen there. They threw floodlights on. We were all panicked, you know. And they had seen the car, and they looked in the back seat, and you know you can lift up the seats of these old cars. Just lift them up, and that's a trunk. It's where they used to keep your tools. Only I had a machine gun and a blackjack and a couple of German Lugers. They were all blocked up. They were prop guns. But we had a terrible time talking our way out of that.
Well, imagine.
Yeah, I should think so.
Because even, I didn't realize this at the time, even for a blocked up machine gun, you have to have a permit just to have it, even though it couldn't possibly work.
Well, I think that's true of a handgun in New York.
It may be in New York. It is in California.
Because I know the sound effects men, if you remember, had to have licenses for the blanks there, which they were all blocked up 38s. And there wasn't a sound man I knew at NBC or CBS that didn't have a permit, which is ridiculous. I'd completely forgotten that, but I'm quite sure that you'll find it still true.
Well, I know that if a movie studio, I guess television studio, rents a machine gun that works, even with blanks, of course. But if you rent one that works, you must, it's a $10 a day permit, plus you must pay the salary per diem of a federal officer to be with that gun at all times.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
That's pretty wild. It really is.
Don't be caught with one in a violin case.
How long has this show been on?
My program?
Uh-huh.
It went on the last Tuesday in March 1965.
Oh, it's been on that long.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, heard on the West Coast, isn't it?
It's heard in Los Angeles and San Francisco.
So because somebody wrote me when the other show appeared on the air shortly.
Oh, really? We didn't say you were on LCBB. Life Can Be Beautiful.
Right. But a friend of mine wrote and said he'd heard the interview and got very nostalgic about it.
Who knew you.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, it was Dick Widmark, who knows me pretty well.
Well, I'm very flattered that he listened.
Yes.
Well, Dick is reasonably atypical, I think, of the normal idea of a Hollywood star.
Yes.
He's a very quiet, articulate guy. He's
a very bright,
delightful
nice
man.
Person.
Very nice. I never met him, but he was a client of an office I worked for here in New York, a public relations firm, handled, you know, big Hollywood stars. Many of them never came in, and I wasn't assigned to the ones that were, assigned me to people that no one else wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hugh O'Brien and people like that, because I was low man on the totem pole. And one day, Richard Widmark was on the phone with my boss, who was a woman. And I heard her talk to him, and she put down the phone, and I said, who was that? She said, that was Dick Widmark. And I said, did you say that to him? He had said, she wanted him to model for Gentleman's Quarterly. I think that was it. And he said, I'm coming all the way from Bucks County to put on a sport coat that I wouldn't wear anyway. No, thank you. He said, I don't need that. She said, well, you need some publicity. He said, no. He said, as a matter of fact, Lois, I've been thinking about it. I don't think I need your office at all. I don't know why I have them. I'm paying you $600 a month. What do I need you for? She said, well, we need you. Isn't that a consideration? We need you. He says, do you? Oh, she says, yes, we do. We need your money, Dick. He says, all right.
Yeah, well, he's that kind of
so you see,
right,
guy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, he and his wife live very quietly out in the valley somewhere and never attend any of the parties or anything else. And are very, very happy to see any of their old friends who come out from New York. But he, I didn't know it was heard out there until I got this card from Dick.
He was on Big Sister a lot, I think. He had a running part on Big Sister.
Yes.
He may have been the naughty brother. I remember she had a brother.
He was on Rosemary, this other show I did a lot, and he was on George
Jordan. He played the lead.
And he used to do quite a few.
He did one title role, the name of which I don't remember, of course, today.
Yeah.
and he was the upstanding, outstanding, all-American boy on everything he ever did. And as a matter of fact, I think he has a kind of affection for me because I directed him in the first Menace he ever played.
Oh, really?
And he was absolutely petrified. He came in and I was producing and directing the Hercule Poirot show.
Oh, I remember that very well.
I owned it along with Harold Huber, who played the title.
Right around
45, 6, and 7.
Yeah, but I was thinking it was around Amos Nandy time.
Yeah, we were on at 7 o'clock every 5 nights a week.
Right, that was a good show. Folk. Congratulations. I liked that very much.
And we had this one very suspenseful script, which was very, very well done. And the killer was a psychopath. And I said, "This is your part, Dick." And he said, "Carl, I don't play that kind of part." I said, "Well, I want you to play him exactly as if he were the sweetest, most lovable man that ever happened. Because it'll be twice as horrifying at the end of the script when you try to throw the lady off Brooklyn Bridge." And he was marvelous in it because he played it so engagingly. And then in the last scene, much to his own surprise, I think, he turned so vicious and so horrible, and he was so marvelous, it sent chills even up my spine, and obviously I knew the script pretty well.
Do you remember an actor named Alan Baxter?
Oh, very well.
Yeah, I don't think he works a great deal anymore, but I remember him in the 30s, and he played sort of Dick Whitmark roles before there was a Dick Whitmark in movies. Gee, I thought he was spooky. He used to scare me.
Yeah, but he looked at it, too, and
he had
a wonderful vocal quality as well as an almost psychopathic look physically.
Boris Karloff and I traveled from the West Coast together at one time because of publicity they were doing on Lights Out. And I remember that was one of my exciting experiences because I was about 18 at the time and I was with the most frightening man in America, you know. But he's the most charming British gentleman, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, so different. I had dinner with him once years ago.
He's a
delightful
really
person,
is,
yeah.
Great
but
job.
His image, you know, was of a monster. And I must say, I had pause when I thought of making the trip all the way back from the coast.
Do you remember in Arsenic and Old Lace when people kept looking at him and saying, "Hey, you look very much like a..." It was beautiful. Nobody ever called him Boris Karloff. He was just the gangster brother-in-law, if you remember.
Yeah.
And everybody, when they saw him, did a take. It was really lovely casting him in the part.
Mm-hmm.
They made a movie of Baby's Irish Rose. Did either of you see that?
No, I didn't think so.
No one else did either because it lost a lot of money. Bing Crosby produced it.
Oh, really?
I don't know why I remember that, but I do.
Uh-huh.
And I looked up the year. It's 1946. And it said the cast, and I've never heard of Richard Norris. Maybe he was a hot actor at the time.
Was he A.B.?
Yes, and Joanne Drew was Rosemary.
I don't remember that.
I never saw the picture. As a matter of fact, the first time I heard they had made
it. It was a big bomb. I don't know how it could have been, really. I mean, just the title alone, you think, would have brought people in.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember at the time, I guess that's why I remember that Bing Crosby produced it.
Well, I think everyone knew the story by then. It had been done so many ways for so long, you know, that I think...
And even in retrospect, I must say, for openers, it was really not a classic, you know.
There was a line I remember from it, and it would have been the father of A.B., I guess. And he used to say, he would be laughing, and the other father would say, "What are you laughing at?" He'd say, "I don't know. I'm laughing. What's the matter? There's a law against that?"
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
That was Teddy Bergman.
Teddy Bergman.
I think they
Alan
used to kind of open the show with
Alan
that,
Reed.
Didn't they?
Alan Reed. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a stock opening, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
It just came to me now.
I think so.
Then, of course, Menasha was so marvelous in the radio series that his part kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. He was just the brother-in-law at first, wasn't he?
But it's always interesting with these theater people. I remember working with Stella Adler once. Their pace was so different than the pace of someone who is accustomed to radio. And Menasha, when he first started to do the script, would be so slow compared to the rest of us, you know, because he was feeling it through at more levels. And for a while, they thought he really couldn't do it. He sounded awfully funny, but he just was so much slower. But then very quickly, they began to find that that was the most attractive thing about him and about his work.
Yeah, I'm sure you've been told many times that glibness in radio
yes,
is as much of an asset as talent.
You see, is often a substitute for feeling, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. I remember I did a series with Helen Hayes. In 1940, it was Star Time or something, and we did the first reading around the table, as we always did for everything, if you remember, and Adrian Samish, who was directing it, said, "We're about 7 minutes over, and I can cut that one whole scene out. It'll run about 4 minutes." And Helen said, "If you cut one word of that scene, I'll kill you." And she had fallen so much in love with it, the first reading was terrible. But she was feeling her way through it, trying to find something. She said, "Maybe we do it just once more."
Yeah.
And then Adrian sat there and he cried when she did the scene over again. He said, "Okay, I won't touch a word, Helen."
Mm-hmm.
So that was so typical of the theatrical approach to radio.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been very pleasant. I'm sorry we're going to have to say goodbye now because we're running out of time. But we were doing a program. We started out on AB's Irish Rose and we got into all kinds of things. Boris Karloff and Dick Widmark and so forth. My guests today have been Miss Betty Winkler, who played Rosemary, and she played a number of other things, too, but in AB's Irish Rose, and Mr. Carl Eastman, who's been on this program before, and thanks again for coming up.
Well, thanks so much for letting me see here. I enjoyed it very much again.